Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 24th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into today's topic, I want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible each week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that is predominantly because I rely on the support of listeners just like you. Sort of a PBS model, sort of like an NPR situation, but it's just me. It's just me and my little team. If you want to pledge your support, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. This week's top patrons include Mary Neva, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. If you want to hear your name at the top of the show, just visit once again patreon.com/Cara Santa Maria and pledge your support on an episodic basis. All right, let's dive into this week's episode. So I had the opportunity to speak to the author of Great Adaptations, Star-Nosed Moles, Electric Eels, and Other Tales of Evolution's Mysteries Solved. And this was written by Dr. Kenneth Catania. And Dr. Catania is a neuroscientist. He actually works as the Stevenson Professor of Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University. His CV is very impressive. Not only is he a MacArthur Award winner, but also a Guggenheim Fellowship Award winner. And has written for several different outlets like Scientific American, Natural History Magazine, The Scientist. He's a National Science Foundation Career Award winner, and his research is fascinating. So we had the opportunity to dive deep and to talk about star-nosed moles, to talk about electric eels, and a handful of other really cool things. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Ken Catania. Ken, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Cara. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about your new book. So it is called Great Adaptations, Star-Nosed Moles, Electric Eels, and Other Tales of Evolution's Mysteries Solved. And really, the kind of overarching concept of this book and what I'm so excited to talk to you about is like the weirdness that can happen with evolution, the sort of interesting effects that we then observe and go, how did that, why would that? But of course, there's a perfectly good explanation, and I'm pumped to dive into it. But before we do, I did notice that, you know, you were a neuroscientist first, right? That's sort of your path in biology.
Yes, that's right. So neuroscience is first, and still, I would say, though I'm leaning more and more towards behavior, because what the animals do is really astounding, and that's a lot of fun to look at. So I try to incorporate that whenever possible, of course, because brains are there to basically control behavior. So they are sort of integrated in that sense.
So before we start talking about some of the kind of creatures that you feature in the book, I'm wondering a little bit more about the research that you're sort of actively doing. Maybe are you teaching any courses right now? Sort of what is your day-to-day like?
Yeah, so I teach a course that maybe not surprisingly essentially covers the kinds of things I talk about in the book. It's a course that's called sometimes neuroethology as the subject. The actual title is Neurobiology of Behavior. And it's a great, fun course to teach because it's one of the places where you can essentially talk about all the sort of animal specializations that I think are so very interesting, like bat echolocation, how do sharks find their prey, how do different animals like pit vipers integrate the infrared sense and vision, and those sorts of things. So it's a real feedback, not only intellectually, but also sometimes in terms of research for what I do in the lab and what I teach. So it's a lot of fun to do.
And what kind of stuff are you really focused on right now in the lab?
You know, I go through different phases, as you probably can guess from the book. So right now, of course, because of COVID, things have been quite sparse for the last year. So I'm eager to get back to things. The latest thing that I was looking at, it was following up on these zombie-making jewel wasps that are really, this sort of stemmed from a Halloween lecture that I like to give. So I like when Halloween rolls around. It's one of my favorite holidays. I try to teach about something that's spooky and engaging. And the perfect example is these emerald jewel wasps that make essentially zombies out of these cockroaches that they need to subdue in order to reproduce. And so there's a lot of creepy aspects to that story. And I initially got these animals, the wasps, to sort of pump up the Halloween lecture a bit. And I'll tell you, this always happens to me. I stumbled into some really interesting things that nobody had seen before. And so it became a research project. And so that was the latest thing in the lab that I did. But I did have to sort of shut that all down when COVID came along, sadly.
Wait, so do you usually choose research projects or kind of areas that you investigate based on like, just, that's a weird thing. I want to study that. Is it really a fundamental like curiosity about the behavior or about the phenotype of the animal itself?
It is. I mean, your question really gets to something that I don't have a really great answer for, in the sense, and you would think I would. You would think, okay, this is my process. And actually, that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book. I wanted to sort of tell the story of how these things happen. How is it that I do choose an animal? How is it that I do make a discovery? And I had to sit back and think about that myself a bit. And I realized that a lot of it is serendipity, in the sense that I might be teaching about an animal. I do a lot of photography, so I like to bring animals in just to document what's going on. And in the process of doing that, I often get intrigued with something I see, and that some of those things have turned into the most interesting stuff I've ever studied. So rather than sort of sitting back in a chair and thinking, I should do X, I really try to let the animals, and sort of, to be more technical, let the data lead me into my next sort of pathway into the research.
And so I love that there is this sort of direct link between your active research and the different species that you highlight in your book. So maybe before we start to dive into the individual species and some of the kind of interesting stories that you try to capture for the audience, we can do a refresher about some of the concepts that are necessary to understand about evolution. Because I think one of the most important kind of takeaways, at least for me, or one of the most important, maybe not takeaways, but I don't know, things that we need to highlight, is that, let's say we were an alien anthropologist, wrong word, an alien zoologist here on Earth, and we were looking around at all of these fascinating creatures that surround us, and we might scratch our heads a little and say, how did that come to be? That must have been created, or that must have been a fluke, that must have been an accident. But we know that these things that look like crazy weird outcomes and quirks are just, you know, basic phenomena. They're just things that happen as a function of what we understand about evolution. So I'm just wondering, before we dive into the actual individual organisms, if we could talk a little bit about some of the main foundational takeaways of evolution that you think are important or necessary to know?
Well, it's a really interesting aspect of the work that I do. So one of the things that I often start out looking at is actually something that would almost turn your question a little on its head. I often look at something and I think, This seems virtually impossible.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
How could this come to be? And the prime example of that is the star-nosed mole. If you just were to look at that animal in isolation, and you might think, how could this possibly evolve? In fact, some organizations had used some of the early research as sort of evolution, as an example of something that was like the eye that couldn't have evolved because it's so complicated, so weird. And what often ends up happening when, for lots of these different cases and for lots of other biology studies, is you start out with something that seems very inexplicable. And then you start to dig down into looking at it and you find, oh, wait a minute, there's intermediate stages here. And so the variation that you see across the different species when you start to get in there, it's sort of recapitulating Darwin's experiences when he goes to the Galapagos and looks at these finches and says, well, wait a minute, you know, all these birds look so different usually that I think about, but here's a place where there's lots of little variations and it seems like this is more easily explained by something else than creation. So when you, for example, look at the star-nosed mole example, when I started doing the research, what I found was there's actually lots of intermediate type of creatures, moles, that are adapted sort of like the star-nosed mole. They have similar sensory organs, and I actually ended up stumbling into finding a protostar. So sort of the intermediate stage between a star-nosed mole and the more normal kinds of moles. So that's a theme that sort of runs through this, is that when you look at the variation in most of these species, things that seem very inexplicable, suddenly you start to see that there's a lot of living intermediates. And of course, those aren't ancestors, but they tell you what ancestors were probably like.
Yeah. So when you mentioned this sort of intermediate for the star-nosed mole, you're saying the kind of, what did you call it? The proto-star?
Yeah, there's a species on the West Coast that basically has the beginnings of a star shape on it. And, you know, this is one of the things that I talk about in one of the chapters. And that's basically that, you know, you find these other interesting links. So I think of these as detective stories. You start out with just a few clues, and then you start to get led into the mystery by more and more clues as you go along. And one of the added clues to how the star came about to be is the development of the star. It's a totally strange developmental sequence. And if you go through the book, you'll see some of the pictures of these embryos, and they look like aliens. I mean, they look like something that is from another planet, but they develop in a sequence that explains the evolutionary trajectory of the star. So you can find these clues in really unexpected places.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you're sort of tapping into this, you know, it doesn't always hold water, but this kind of like, what is it? Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, or am I saying that backward? No, I'm saying it correctly.
Yeah. So Stephen Jay Gould did this great book on, you know, on the relationship between development and evolution. And I always, you know, I always think basically, you know, trying to get a little less jargony, basically development can kind of sometimes replay an evolutionary sequence. And there's a big debate there, you know, historically the people have said, oh, well, you know, development replays evolution. And of course, that's not the way it really works, but there are good clues to evolution in development if you know where to find them. And that was sort of the theme of Gould's book. So little bits of puzzle pieces, you know, collected from a lot of different interesting areas.
And the mechanisms of kind of the way that you approach investigating some of these outcomes, do they tend to be more on the developmental side? Are you mostly looking at the developmental biology? Are you looking at the behavior of the you know, adult organisms? Clearly, you're not looking at the, you're not approaching this from like a paleo perspective. Like all of these would be, you know, I guess, lines of evidence that would come together. But what specific perspective do you tend to research?
I try to not bring a perspective to the research.
Okay.
That might sound a little strange. And I've done a lot of thinking about ways of approaching science, because often people will ask me, you know, how did you do this? How do you find these various sort of discoveries? How does it come about? And so I've had to stop and think about that a little bit. And one of the things that I realize I try to do might seem a little bit counterintuitive, because, you know, we think about science as you come up with your hypothesis and then you maybe try to test between A, B, and C. That's sort of the textbook sort of view from the 10,000 feet view of science. And I definitely do come up with sort of questions and hypotheses, but I try to start by letting the animals tell me what's interesting by observing their behavior, so to speak. So I'll give an example of this. I talk about in the book, how I first got involved in a really fun research project in star-nosed moles very early on. And that was a question about whether or not the star could be used to detect electric fields. And that's a very cool idea. It's one of these things that, had it been true, would be, you know, spectacular in terms of a finding. And I'll just mention as an aside that there's a precedent for this kind of thing. So the duckbill platypus can detect electric fields with its bill. So this is a sense called electroreception. Anyway, so that was something that was a theory about star-nosed moles. And I spent, you know, a year or so or more as an undergraduate research assistant at the National Zoo working on that question. And what it turns out is that sort of was a question generated by thinking about what the star might do without close observation of exactly what was going on. And so I learned a big lesson there to you can sort of sit back and think about what an animal might do, or you can sort of start off with a closer sort of meshing with the data of what you're looking at and try to take that as your starting point. And so that's what I try to do these days. That's sort of a long answer.
I think it's great. And it reminds me, actually, this is like such a random aside, but I was rewatching Awakenings the other day, the book based on the film based on Oliver Sacks's book about the post-encephalitic Parkinsonism patients. And there's a funny scene at the beginning when he's applying for the job at this clinic in the Bronx in the 60s. And he's talking about a research project where he's like, it was an immense undertaking. We were to remove one decagram of myelin from 800 tons of earthworms or something like that. And the guy who runs the hospital is like, it can't be done. And he goes, I know, I proved it. And it just reminded me of like how important sometimes negative results really are to science. That
absolutely.
That try and not find the thing that we've been looking for sometimes to show which trees are worth barking up.
Absolutely. I mean, you bring up a great point. So, you know, I feel like I should touch on that. So, you know, the book is basically covering, it's a series of case studies of these really interesting discoveries that lead one from another to basically showing how incredibly interesting these animals are. So part of the reason I wrote the book was because I wanted people to get the backstory of how this research happens, how much fun it could be, and how incredible the animals are when you get a really close look at them. But what you brought up is a really good point, and it's something that I don't highlight in the book, but I kind of feel like I should say for those people who are starting out in science, what I didn't cover was all the failures. And science is full of failures. And that's just something that goes with the territory. It's very useful. And half the time, those failures, the process of having that failure, will lead you to the next step that's absolutely key. And I just thought I should put in that little, you know, addendum, almost a confession of sorts, because I wouldn't want people starting out in science to think that, oh, all you have to do is start down this road and everything will turn out well. Failure is part of it, like it is in everything else in life. It's just part of the way things go.
Yeah. So I've got to kind of circle back to the star-nosed mole because it's such a weird animal. And for individuals who maybe don't have any exposure to it, I was hoping maybe you could describe it a little bit.
Sure. It is this very bizarre little mammal that lives in wetlands in the northeastern United States and up into Canada. And since it was first described, as you can imagine, it was a complete mystery. It was one of these things where, you know, people, it was sort of, as I say in the book, it was sort of a walking, breathing question. You know, what the heck is this thing? How could it evolve? What does the star do? So I'll mention that, you know, moles are probably, a lot of people have moles in their yard, and people think of them as little rodents, and they're not rodents. They're actually distantly related to mice and rats. They're more closely related to shrews. And so it's a very interesting animal that lives and does not hibernate, lives in wetlands in North America, and basically makes its living underground in a sort of unique environment. And it'll also swim. It can do incredible things. I feel like I should mention one of the aspects of the book is I wanted people to be able to see some of the things the animals do. And it's a little bit subtle. I kind of put this in as something for people to discover. But there are QR codes next to a lot of the images. And all you have to do is aim your phone camera at that, and it'll take you straight to movies of the animals in action from...
Cool.
Yeah, so give that a try if you get a chance. And if you want to see what a star-nosed mole can do, it's the fastest foraging animal in the world. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records. And if you want to see it in action, you can do that. And it's just mind-blowing how fast it can move.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. What an interesting idea. Was this an idea that you came up with, or is it something that your publisher recommended? How did you? It's so funny because we definitely have the technology for it, but like no books do this.
Right. It's something I came up with, and you know, this goes back to sort of the process of science. Actually, it links back to that. So when I publish papers on these different findings, I think of some of the stuff as so extraordinary that I want other scientists and readers of the paper to see the behavior. So most of my published papers have what are called supplementary movies. And of course, the thing is, it's a little bit laborious for somebody who might go to the literature to, you know, go through the paper, find the movies, go to the movies. And yet these movies, I think, are really telling. And I wanted readers of the book to be able to see, to have that experience. So I had a little bit of a precedent for this in the papers, but I wanted to make it easy, really easy. So, the technology had sort of gotten to the place where you can just aim the camera of your phone at it. You don't need to download an app or anything. And when I saw you could do that, I thought, okay, we just got to do this. So people can see what's going on with these creatures.
Oh, yeah. I'm watching a tentacled snake hunt right now as we're talking.
Oh, that's a great that's a great story.
Oh, my gosh. But we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah.
Let's finish up with Mr. Star-Nosed or Miss Star-Nosed.
Sure.
So, okay. You're looking at these star-nosed moles. You're early on in your research. You're trying to figure out about the kind of, I guess, function. I don't want to say purpose. I feel like that's a misnomer, but the function of the star nose and what kinds of things we know now that you discover that no, there is no sort of electrical potential there, but what kinds of things did you or have you discovered throughout your research?
Yeah. So, this sort of leads down this path that I was sort of describing that seems to always happen. So early on, I ended up discovering what would seem like let me back up a little bit and say, first off, you know, where do you start with that kind of question?
Right.
Right. So part of it is behavior. That's important. But the other part is, let's start with the star. What the heck is the star itself? And the star is completely covered with a single kind of sensory organ called an Eimer's organ. And it turns out that this little tiny thing, it's like a little bump on the skin surface that you can only see under a microscope. And there's about 25,000 of these things. And I should mention that the star is only about the size of your fingertip.
Okay. And they almost look like taste buds or something like that.
Yeah.
Like a corn cob.
Yeah, that's a good description of what they look like. And so then the question is, what are those things? So it turns out that the star-nosed mole is not the only mole that has these. They are incredibly sensitive touch receptors. And the first thing you might think is, well, okay, mole lives underground, makes sense, would have a good sense of touch. And that doesn't seem all that extraordinary. And then, you know, things get more interesting, though, when you start to delve a little deeper. It turns out that the star is innervated by 100,000 nerve fibers. And the human hand, for touch, the touch receptors in the human hand are supplied by about 17,000 nerve fibers. So you've got five times more resolution in something the size of your fingertip. And so just trying to imagine the amount of acuity that this creature has, five, because the human hand is really properly held up as an incredibly acute sensory organ.
Yeah, especially at the fingertips.
Absolutely. And it's thought to underlie, you know, some of the reasons that we've evolved to do the things we can do. So imagine having five times that compressed into the size of your fingertip. So that's one sort of parameter that makes this animal interesting. And so the next question, and Kara, I know you'll appreciate this side from your neuroscience background, is what about the brain maps? Could there be interesting things there in terms of this animal's brain? And so just for your listeners, you know, one of the aspects of human brains and all mammal brains is that the sense of touch is laid out, organized in what you might call a little homunculus, like a little version of the body of the animal in a particular area of the brain, in a particular area of the neocortex. And so that was sort of the next question. What about this animal's brain? Well, it turns out, and this was done in collaboration with one of the major investigators, John Koss, here at Vanderbilt University, that you can actually see the star in the anatomy of the brain when the brain is properly prepared. It's like you could see the human hand, you know, in yeah. your brain, literally in the anatomy.
Yeah. And
so that was another cool thing, sort of like you say. And that in turn, this is like dominoes falling, led to another question. Because when you look at this visible brain map, one part of it is huge, bigger than it should be based on the part of the star that it represents. And that led us to the discovery that the star actually has what you would call a touch fovea. So, you know, we have this little high-resolution area of our eyes that we use to scrutinize things in detail. Like, if one of your readers were to be reading a passage in a book and you held your eyes still, immediately you'll sort of recognize, wow, I don't see things like a picture. I'm moving around this little spotlight of high resolution.
And that's where, like, we've got the highest concentration of cones.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the star knows mole. A touch fovea.
Exactly. So there's
Do we have one of those?
You know, not, I would say not really. I mean, you might think of your fingertips as a little bit like that. And then you get into that, well, how do you define things? And what's the, you know, there's sort of, you know, these sort of blurry borders between some definitions of things. But the star knows mole absolutely does. There's one area that it uses just the way we use an eye. So that led to, let's look at the behavior more closely. And that's when I sort of previously mentioned that this turns out to be the fastest foraging animal in the world, for a mammal anyway.
And you saw this sort of, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but this sort of relationship, this part really interests me, between this, what we think of as this kind of weird modified organ that is like some sort of like evolution run amok, but really that it's fundamentally related to exactly how most mammals that we think of that are quadrupeds, that are down near the ground, cats and dogs and mice and stoats and, you know, all these different mammals that have whiskers on their face. It's a very similar phenomenon, right?
It is. It's sort of like they replaced their sort of feeler whiskers with little fleshy appendages that actually give them a little leg up on the sense of touch because they're more sensitive.
This is why I have to say it bums me out. I just got my dog back from the groomer, and even though he looks adorable, I'm like, why do they cut their whiskers?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, one of our dogs will trim off the whiskers on the other dog through grooming it.
And I'm like, no, they rely on those. Maybe our dogs don't as much, but still, that's like, it gives them a sense of touch, right? It helps them navigate Absolutely. The world with their faces.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. So you know, the star-nosed mole has been a staple of your investigative life for quite some time, and I can imagine that you that it holds a special place kind of in your heart. But there are, of course, other species that you have allowed in that
Absolutely. You have
warmed up to over the years as well. So maybe we can do maybe we can spend a little bit of time with a couple other species
sure.
as well. Obviously,
Absolutely.
We're not going to get to everything in the book, which is a good thing because
yeah,
the whole point
yeah.
is to go buy the book
yeah.
and read it. But what would stand out to you next? Is it an electric eel?
Yeah, I can't not talk about electric eels. You know, those animals, it's sort of one of those things where, you know, you ever run into someone who's come back from some trip and or seen something, or maybe a fishing expedition would be the right analogy. And they're just, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, I feel like when I look at some of the results and the things that electric eels can do, they are absolutely extraordinary. Some of the most amazing stuff I've ever seen in my career. And it's a real lesson because that animal has been studied for centuries. It is something that has contributed a lot to our understanding of, for example, the neuromuscular junction. It's a place where we learned about the channels that allow our nervous system to communicate with our muscles through these acetylcholine receptors. And so, you know, those were essentially first isolated from electric eels. And that's just a little bit of a backstory to say that there's two kinds of things that I would say sort of go on with this kind of research. And one is the what you might think of as the model species approach, where we try to learn something maybe related to human health and medicine. And one of the things that I like to do is sort of sometimes related to that, but to just look at it, maybe the way you'd think of the Hubble Space Telescope. Let's just take a look and see what amazing things might be out there. And that
just be open.
Just be open and appreciate the extraordinary things that are in our world. And the electric eel is one of those. So with that preamble, so what am I talking about? Well, everybody would probably guess that an electric eel can shock creatures around it and kind of stun them. But it turns out that it uses its high voltage in this incredibly sophisticated way as a predator. So essentially, it's giving off high voltage in pulses of electricity, little blips of electricity. It's a lot like the way a taser works, giving off pulses of electricity. And a taser will essentially freeze up a person's muscles, and that will prevent them from moving. And so that's when a taser is working functionally. It doesn't matter how big and strong you are, how motivated you are. If it's working, your muscles are frozen up and you can't move. And it turns out that's what electric eels are doing a lot of the time with their high voltage, is essentially remotely controlling the nervous systems of other animals. And as soon as I made that sort of discovery, you know, you mentioned sort of evolution earlier on. Well, think about, and this is what I had to think about, where could evolution go once you've got an animal that's remotely controlling other animals' nervous systems? There's some really interesting possibilities there. And it turns out eels took advantage of this. And by that, I mean, sometimes they'll freeze up their prey with a volley of high voltage that does what a taser does. But when they're uncertain whether something they might want to eat, and the eels are all about food, they'll basically give off blips of high voltage to force nearby animals to move that are hiding, and that will cause the animal to reveal itself to the eel. So it's got these two modes of of remotely controlling animals with its high voltage, so much more sophisticated than sort of this blanket idea that you kind of stun an animal.
Right. And it makes you wonder sometimes. And I think some of this, when it comes to evolutionary biology, but especially as you start to get into like evolutionary neuroscience or even evolutionary psychology, we do have to be cautious to kind of check ourselves and say, you know, this might be speculative, but that doesn't mean it's not interesting and they're not interesting questions to ask. But it makes me wonder, you know, how much of this was an evolved behavior that was in lockstep with mechanism and how much of it was something that was like capitalizing on a capability that evolved for a different reason, right? Like, I can already do this. Let's use that to my advantage. Let's figure out how to make it even more effective at reproduction or at, you know, getting prey or whatever the case may be. I mean, I think human beings are a perfect example of that. I don't think that we ever evolved for poetry, for example.
Right.
But we're able to do that, and that's pretty dang cool.
Absolutely.
It makes you wonder, and I don't know if there ever could be an answer to that question, but how much of the electric eel's behavior is just like a cool side effect of what they were already had the equipment to do.
I think you're exactly right. You hit the nail on the head there. So they evolved from these small electric fish that are probing their environments with electricity. I mean, it's an absolutely amazing sense and ability. I think kind of underappreciated, even in sort of aquarium stores, you'll have these little electric fish, and a lot of people don't know that they have electric organs and are giving off this electricity. And so the trajectory of the evolution of the electric eel, as you sort of implied, is almost certainly, I would say certainly, evolved from this sense that, you know, and as it grew in power, eventually the animal crossed a threshold where it went from sensing its environment to being able to affect the nervous systems of nearby animals. And then as soon as that sort of leap was made, then it could sort of blossom into sort of a weapon. I like to joke, a weapon of mass destruction, you know, in terms of what it could do with this massive electric organ. And so you're right about this trajectory being from, you know, something else and sort of flipping to a new ability. And one of the reasons that this is also related to the research and how amazing the eels are. One of the reasons that that's almost certainly the trajectory was this serendipitous discovery that I made while looking at the eels, which is that they use their high voltage output to track the animals at the same time that they're using it to immobilize the animals. So they never lost that sensory side of their electrical output. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's straight out of like a science fiction story. It's like having laser vision where you could see something and fry it with your eyes. Essentially, I mean, you know, I really kind of feel that way about the eel. It's literally sensing animals in its environment with high voltage and attacking them with high voltage. And so I can joke about that sort of superpower, and I think it's a great analogy. But it's also a really interesting aspect in terms of evolution, because those are two very different functions and they're occurring with the same output. And I think that's an intriguing aspect of what electric eels can do. Anyway, you can tell I'm obsessed with them.
I love this because I think it also throws on its ear. I don't know. I'm try and follow me here, and I apologize if it's a bit meandery. But recently on the show, I had on she wrote Why Fish Don't Exist, Lulu Miller.
Yeah.
And we were talking a lot about this concept of like taxonomy in the sciences, labeling things, constructive, you know, developing constructs, labeling, bucketing, lumping, splitting, all this good stuff that we know are like kind of age old arguments and conversations, especially within evolutionary biology, but really within the sciences as a whole. And how, you know, human beings, and we know this when we read like Kuhn, human beings are coming at science with their own biases. And so we think of like this, you know, maps back to our backgrounds in neuroscience. We think of like sensory systems and motor systems as like incredibly distinct, right? Like you've got your sensory area and it can map to this part of your brain. You've got your motor area, it can map to this part of the brain. And I think it's really cool when we see examples within physiology where it sort of blows up our very clean and neat categories, and it forces us to go, wait a minute, You know, just because we're usually able to put things in buckets doesn't mean they always fit in those buckets. And it makes us realize that that we can't be so constrained when we first approach problems, because we won't see things if we approach all problems with the constraints of, well, this is how it's always been. It must be how it's always going to be.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And I think, you know, it's funny, I'm considering a second book and trying to think about and talk about the approach to scientific questions where you do approach it with a little bit of a less constrained sort of approach, just as you were describing. I think that's a key aspect of looking at biology, and especially when you're mapping out really unusual new territory that you just really don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's almost like every biologist, when they're, you know, starting to dive deep into, like you said, into new territory, should like sit down with a focus group of children, or should sit down with experts in completely different fields and just talk to them and listen to the questions that the people ask, like, well, how come it, why wouldn't it be like this? Well, couldn't it also happen like this? And really listen with open, because we're so ready to just discount alternative explanations because we're like, that's not how biology works. But right. It's like, well, maybe it does. Maybe we just right. kind of forgot that there are alternative explanations out there.
Right.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's really, really cool. And so I can imagine that that's happened to you kind of time and time again in your research, that you've had to go, wait a minute, I can't keep looking at this the way I've always looked at things. There's, you know, I've got to look at this with fresh eyes, with a little bit of kind of a naive perspective in order to make sense of what I'm seeing in front of my face.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the challenges. And of course, the biggest challenge is you don't really know what your own preconceptions are. So I think that I try, you know, I always try to come at these scientific problems with a very open mind. Of course, how do I know just how open I'm being? What am I missing? You know, that's the thing that would keep me up at night, right? What have I missed? There's so much out there to discover. And a lot of it is hiding in plain sight, I would say.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny because, again, sorry, this is like a random aside, but I am working on my PhD now after being away from academia for 12 years or something like that. So it's been an interesting experience being kind of like an old PhD student. And, you know, I came from a more kind of traditional scientific background. My master's is in neurobiology. And so I'm used to like kind of the standard quantitative approach to things, the sort of hypothesis testing approach. But I have decided, and I'm working on getting candidacy just this semester. So I'm trying to finish up my proposal. So I'll be ABD. My proposal, and this is, sorry, a little wonky for some people who might be listening, but I think it's kind of apropos here. I've decided to do a qualitative dissertation, which I did not know existed until I entered into psychology. And this is something that you see quite a lot in the social sciences. And to get a little bit wonky, there's a type of qualitative approach called phenomenology, which is based on Heidegger's philosophies. And it's a way of kind of approaching truth or approaching reality. It's a different kind of what he would consider scientific approach than what we think of as traditional hypothesis testing. And there are two ways to do it. So there was Husserl, who said, we all have implicit biases. We need to set them aside. And then we need to listen to other people's experiences, the phenomena, and make sense of them and try and, you know, gain insights. And then Heidegger came along and said, we all have implicit biases. It's impossible to set them aside. So what we actually need to do is make them explicit. And then we'll listen to somebody else's experience of a phenomenon. And then we will adjust our own biases based on this new knowledge. And then we'll go through the circle again and again. And that's called the hermeneutic circle. And it's such an interesting approach because it really speaks to exactly what you were just talking about. We sometimes don't know what our biases are. So we try to introspect. We try to say, this is what I think about a problem. I'm going to I'm going to make that explicit. I'm now going to do some investigation. And now I'm being challenged. New things are coming up for me that make me question my preconceived notions. Let me make those explicit again and keep going down that process. And I kind of feel like that qualitative approach is what's missing from a lot of quantitative science, is that the researchers were never taught, and you know, we just don't think it's appropriate to explicitly state our biases in our endeavors. But that might actually be a sort of iteration and improvement on the scientific method to say, I'm a person. I was always taught this. And so I went into this research assuming this was the case, and I have been proven wrong.
Yeah, that is an interesting take on it. It reminds me, you know, one of the books I'm just now reading is Julia Galef's The Scout Mindset.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm really enjoying that. And I guess, it, you know, now we're going off on, a little bit of a tangent, but it, you know, it does, I do like her take on the fact that, you know, you really need to examine the way that you're thinking in different contexts. And especially, I think as, you know, as if you're thinking about science journalism and reporting things, or you're a scientist, it's easy to go from, well, we're looking for figuring out what the answer is, to some aspects of society, as we all know, where it's more of this soldier mindset. And I've sort of realized the one thing I like about her book is that I've experienced it and been confused by it. You know, I've gone from one world to another, and I've had to literally stop and say, oh, right, I'm in this other world where the arguments are being made not really with the goal of discovering what's going on, but with defending a particular side. Anyway,
right.
So, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, I think, can be really transformative as a researcher to introspect, to, like you said, to listen to our own biases, to study philosophy. You know, like most scientists who get a doctorate degree have a, you know, a PhD, a doctor of philosophy degree. But unfortunately, not a lot of them could point to the philosophical underpinnings of their approach to science, or of the way that they think, or the way that they construct their questions. And I know it feels like an aside, but that's how my show so is. Like, it always comes back to this place of really investigating and really, you know, being self-aware of how is it that we do our science? What biases do we bring to the table? And how can we really, I think the truest and most groundbreaking discoveries come to pass when there's a bit of bravery and a bit of fearlessness and a bit of a capability to say, let's put all of these preconceived notions on the shelf, or at least make them explicit so that we can try and push ourselves a little bit. And I feel like that's something that you have really taken to task through all of your work, is to say, okay, when I was a kid, I was learning about these species. I read about them in books about oddities and curiosities. You know, there's an assumption that, like, we know what there is to know about this stuff. Yet, you're able to make these kind of groundbreaking discoveries about behavior and about physiology that scientists who have been studying them for many years didn't make. I mean, they made their own discoveries, and that's because you were able to say, you know, what are we not seeing here? How do we ask this question a different way?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Lately, I have this sort of metaphor of the Hubble Space Telescope, where I feel like, well, actually, you know, and I got that from experiences out in the field. Some of the work that I've done includes field work, and when we'd be out, you know, collecting animals and looking at what's going on, you might bring your binoculars with you and see something flit around and move. And that's the reason that you put them to your eyes and look. But then there's often something that you never would have seen that's in the view when you do that. And that's the way I think of experiments. It's sort of like experiments are the binoculars, and you never know what is going to fall out of that. But in science, it's really experiments are hard, and so it's not as easy as just picking up the binoculars. But it's just as important. It's just as important to do that. And it, in my experience, it's really true that you just can't be sure what you're going to see there. It's interesting. I noticed a lot of parallels when I was trying to write this book with at least what seemed to me to be sort of the struggles that writers have with what the struggles that scientists have. Because science is hard and writing is hard. I learned that, you know, in the process of this book. It was a lot of fun to do, but it's a hard thing to do. And doing experiments is a hard thing to do. So writers struggle with sitting down at the computer and really putting their minds to it. And I think that some scientists, or I know I do, maybe all of us do, it's hard to get into the lab and do those experiments. It's very energy intensive. So it's almost comical. You know, writers are like, you have to Velcro yourself to the chair. And I think maybe scientists have to Velcro themselves to the lab sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, there's just so many, I think, important takeaways here. And it just goes to show, too, not only, you know, in reading your book, are there some really fascinating discoveries and some insights that, you know, help us understand the natural world around us in a way that we didn't before. But there's also, as we've been talking about, this sort of meta component to it, which is all about discovery and all about the foundational understanding that science is done by people, and that, you know, science is done not in a vacuum, but within a cultural milieu. And there's a lot of insight that can be gained from maintaining that perspective as well. Obviously, you know, within an hour, we can't get to everything, unfortunately. But I'm wondering, before we kind of move on to the closing segments of the show, is there anything that, you know, we didn't touch on that you feel like, oh, gosh, I gotta make sure everybody knows this?
Well, one of the things that was a takeaway that I really wanted people to appreciate is that science can be a lot of fun. And that's something that you don't get from the scientific papers. You know, it's almost comical the way, and I don't think it's a bad thing. I think scientific papers need to have a certain amount of rigor and need to be written in a dispassionate way. But it sort of leaves out the backstory of how amazing some of the things that go on and how much fun it can be. And so that's what I hope sort of comes across in these different vignettes, these different stories of some of the different creatures that I've studied. That's one thing that I hope comes across. But the other thing is that nature's absolutely amazing. And, you know, I keep using this metaphor of sort of astronomy. There's so much that we keep discovering just by looking. And I think the same is true of what's going on with biological systems on our planet. And we've hardly explored the universe, and we've hardly explored what's going on around us. And there's just so much to discover.
Absolutely. Well, gosh, on that note, I'm hoping that I can ask you my final two questions that I ask everyone on the show. And in a way, you may have already answered one of them, because you were like, what really keeps me up at night is, earlier when we were talking. And so whether it's a recapitulation of that or whether something new comes up for you, I'm hoping that you could let us know. You know, when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now, it could be personal, it could be global, it could be cosmic. Number one, what is that thing that's keeping you up at night that, you know, you're legitimately concerned about, maybe even a bit pessimistic or cynical about? But on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely and pretty authentically hopeful for? What are you, you know, optimistic about and looking forward to?
Wow, there's a lot to choose from. What am I genuinely worried about? What keeps me? You know, I think this is going to be a little philosophical. I think both of those answers are the two sides of the human imagination. I think that, you know, when we stop to imagine, what would it be like to go to the moon? What would it be like to could we eradicate polio? You know, what would it be like to send a rover to Mars? What would we see? These are all things that require thinking about a future that hasn't happened yet. And I think that's a really, really powerful thing. So I'm doing this maybe in reverse order. The flip side of that is the human imagination of what if cell phone towers cause COVID, or what if there's a chip in the vaccine? Or so I think that our imagination gives us some of our greatest strengths, but it's also one of our most sort of scary attributes. And on a positive note, I think that's the kind of thing that will get us through all this. But I do think it needs to be metered by science, which tells us how to guide our imaginations.
Right. Yeah. I think that's such an important point. And it's one that we often do make on the show. We also often make on the other show that that I work on, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I mean, that really is kind of the foundational message of the show, is that we have these incredible and creative organs, which are fundamental to all of, you know, all of our capabilities here on Earth, and they're fundamental to our existence, but they can lead us astray. You know, they really can, because of the cognitive biases, because of these quirks of evolution that help us in these very natural situations. They help us in fight or flight situations. But then when it comes time to do higher level analytical, critical thinking, oftentimes the very same things that serve us to help us kind of get away from a predator may not be serving us very well in our day-to-day decision-making capabilities. And I think that you really encapsulated that very, very well. So, Ken, I got to thank you so much for your time today. It was not just fascinating, but like a really fun chat. I'm so excited now to try and, I don't know, go to a zoo or something and observe some of these animals that you talked about.
Well, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it too. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.